Hello and welcome to the new episode of From CEO to End. Today, our guest is Mark Richards. He happens to be a software professional for many years. He has written some books on O'Reilly platform. We were going to talk about his books, which are related to software architecture. And he is also the creator of a website called Developer to Architect that I love. I work to that website a lot to get some lessons. And then there is also this YouTube channel where you can see those lessons. And I'm very happy for having you here, Mark. Thank you very much for being here and saying yes. And I'd like you to introduce yourself to the audience. Like, what do you like to do and where do you live and stuff like that, you know?
Sure, exactly. So, Obed, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. And I have been, I've been in the industry now for 36 years, 26 of those as a software architect. And for about the past 7 years or so, I've devoted most of my career to microservices, and that's kind of helping companies migrate to microservices and also greenfield applications. But technology kind of is a passion of mine, but I also really love to hike. It's one of the other activities that I love to do. And so I've been hiking at a lot of different places, and I've had quite a few adventures, including ones involving mountain lions, frostbite, almost getting hit by lightning. That's happened a lot, actually.
while hiking?
While hiking. Yeah. Just getting stuck on the top of a mountain in bad weather or kind of searching for water. I've run out of water before when I was hiking in the Grand Canyon in Arizona. Lots of great adventures. Oh boy, we could fill up, Obed, an entire podcast of my hiking adventures.
That's great. And that's scary. No, lightning, it's oh boy, you know.
But I do live here in Boston, Massachusetts, in the US. And originally actually from Phoenix, Arizona, where did a lot of my youth. And as a matter of fact, my very first job, I was an astronomer. I worked at an observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, where we were chartered. It was a small observatory, but we were chartered with looking for black holes, variable stars, binary star systems. And so I did that for several years. While I was an astronomer, I was an observational astronomer. So I was, I was awake when everybody else was sleeping.
Yeah.
And my end of day shift was when everybody was waking up.
Yeah.
at the observatory, I actually did a lot of telescope automation. And that's kind of what started launching my career really into IT. So, yeah.
Okay. So you were not a major in computer science?
I did. I have a computer science. I've got a computer science master's degree, but my undergraduate was in mathematics.
Okay.
And so it's wonderful with a mathematics degree here in the States.
Yeah.
You could do a lot with it. You can go into the FBI. You can go into criminal investigations. You can go into science. It really does open up a lot of avenues, finance. But I chose computers. And so, and that led me here.
That's wonderful. I have been in Phoenix while driving to LA because I have family there. And I remember it was very hot, like hotter that you cannot put your arm outside the car because it's like burning. How can you manage to live like that?
you get used to it. I've been out here in Boston for about 36 years or so, and I'm still not used to the humidity out here and the bugs. I miss the desert very much.
Yeah, but it was hot, like hot as hell, you know. It was and that's the thing that I recall most about Phoenix. And that's great that you're a mathematician as well. So I really like mathematics, and I have just software engineer, so I just learned some of the mathematics, but it's a whole world, you know. It's impossible to get all the sense of what mathematics degree can have. So, so the website you have, Developer to Architect, is a wonderful resource for people like myself or any other developer that wants to become an architect. And I see you break down into small sessions or lessons about like 10 minutes where you explain various topics. And what I have learned in this career is that it's a journey that you never are done learning, you know? And I'll like to talk about how you managed to get with this idea of, you know, creating this community or this website where you share your knowledge about it.
Yeah, so I'd love to talk about that. I started it almost 4 years ago. It was in January of 2018 that I actually started it. I created that website just because I was starting to do more training. I kind of have always been doing development work and architecture stuff as well. But I started a transition of realizing, you know, I've got all this knowledge and I'm really not serving the industry well, being as an individual contributor buried within a development team. And so I started to do more training. And it's just one of my other passions. I love training. And what I started to realize was this journey, as you did mention, Obed, correctly, this is a journey. And it's a really difficult one. It's hard to know how do you go from being a developer to being an architect? And how do you know if you are an architect? And all these kind of questions. And so I kind of created that website really as a give back website to be able to help people in this journey. And in there, I kind of provided initially, you know, things like book references, you know, a great bookshelf for architects, articles, videos that I had done and other people have done. And then at the same time, I thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool instead of a podcast, because I do so much writing, as I've written 7 books already. And, and I'm like, I don't want to continue to write. I like to speak. And so I started these Software Architecture Monday, these 10-minute videos of some aspect of software architecture, just to kind of help this. It's totally free. You know, the thing I tried to avoid was you don't need to sign up or, you know, all these kind of things. It's just, it's totally free. I'm not looking for anybody's email or to create a list. It was purely just for give back. You'll notice on there that the lessons originally for about the first 6 months were every week. And that's what every Monday I delivered one. And after about 6 months, Obed, I realized I was starting to run out of material and I was scrambling on Sunday evenings to create slides and a video and record it. And so that's when, just based mostly on my schedule, I had to change it to every other week. But as a matter of fact, I just posted yesterday, as a matter of fact, lesson 126. Talking about if service-oriented architecture, SOA, is dead. But there's a lot of topics with like microservices, general architecture, soft skills. It's a great place to go to get kind of additional information about architecture and to kind of help in that journey.
You just mentioned a keyword, soft skills. You know, soft skills is something that you need to create and cultivate, because now in this era of artificial intelligence, you know, there is a lot of code that's going to be written by itself, you know, with all the things that are happening, like this GitHub Copilot. You just type whatever you want and it grabs some code for you. So now we need to work on our soft skills, which happens to be a very important thing of the development process. And you talk about those soft skills, right? Like technical breadth, where you start learning and learning and learning and stuff like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to talk about what are the soft skills you think we should start cultivating for ourselves to be better or be outstanding architects?
Yeah, that's, you know what, Obed, it's such a great and important question. A lot of people wonder why I focus in my career so much on soft skills. And I like to tell people that, you know, there's a lot of great technologists out there, hundreds of thousands of great developers and tens of thousands of architects out there. And they're all really, really good. So what differentiates you from the rest of the crowd? And that differentiator, well, we all know microservices. We're all really good at microservices. But the differentiator, Obed, is the soft skills. that is how, in my opinion and experience of 36 years, that's how to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. So to answer your question, there are some key soft skills as an architect. I personally maintain and will always maintain, again, based on experience, that a software architect is 50% technical knowledge and 50% soft skills. And that responsibility of an architect is to help lead and guide teams through the implementation of an architecture, to be there to coach and mentor and answer questions. And those soft skills are so key for that. One of the main soft skills that I'll call out, aside from just some general leadership or people skills, is an interesting one: negotiation. One of the key soft skills of any architect is to have really key negotiation skills. And here's exactly why. So Obed, let's say that you're a really great developer and you're coding away and you realize in your code as you're typing that you're getting a lot of cyclomatic complexity. A lot of nested if and if and if, and it's like, you know what? I can't even read this code. And so what do? Well, you take a look at it and you convert that using the template and strategy pattern to be able to reduce all that cyclomatic complexity. And I'll tell you what, Obed, no one's going to question you on that. As a matter of fact, some people may say, hey, can I see your code? Because I've been looking for a really good example of the strategy pattern or the template pattern. Here's the point. As an architect, unfortunately, every decision you make gets challenged. It gets challenged by developers who don't agree with you and think they know a little bit better because they're actually in the code. Your decision gets challenged by other architects who have a different approach or opinion. Your decision gets challenged by business stakeholders who think that your choices are too expensive or will take too long. And in order to get anything done, one of the key skills is to be able to negotiate, to be able to get people on your side and to agree with you. So I always say to developers, enjoy life while you can, because you have so much freedom in all the decisions that you can make. If you choose to break up a class or combine methods, that's your choice. But it's so funny because most developers say, I can't wait to be a software architect because I want to be able to make decisions. Well, it doesn't work that way, my friends.
It's not that easy as it sounds, right?
It's a really frustrating aspect of being a software architect. And some of the ways, and I want to continue on this soft skills piece, because some of the ways that work really well in negotiation is trust and respect. The more development teams trust you and respect you, the more they're going to agree with some of your decisions and feel comfortable challenging them when they see a hole in it, which is good. That's all a win-win. And gaining that trust and respect is all about those people skills and really knowing how to get along with people. And so it all ties in together with all the things an architect does. It's one of those key skills. Another aspect of that is knowing also when to let things go. Part of negotiation is knowing which battles to pick, not to do too much of a cliche. But it is true, though, cliche or not. If you're the kind of architect who fights every decision you make, it's not going to be fun working with you. But if you see something that's more of an opinion and your development team wants to do it another way, and it really doesn't matter much, let it go.
And let it go. Yeah.
Let it go. And you're seen as really reasonable. The thing I love so much about this letting it go piece is this. If you, have an opinion about something and let people have their own way, and then all of a sudden you start fighting for a particular decision, people will notice and say, Mark's really, really fighting for this one. I better look into this deeper. It seems like this is significant because he usually doesn't do this. And those things that I will fight to the death on, swords and everything, is those kind of decisions that impact those kind of architecture characteristics that are important. If scalability and availability are super important, they're critical to the success, and I have an architecture decision that supports those, that's my justification. And I will fight for that because that's what I, as a software architect, am responsible for, are those characteristics. And so it all ties into those people skills, which are just so critical.
Yeah. Soft skills are very important. And being able to negotiate, it's great because there are these things called trade-offs, right? Where you cannot have two things at the same time. You need to sacrifice one or the other. And I guess that comes very handy when you are a good negotiator, because you need to explain the business, for example. You know, this thing is the best thing to do it, but it's going to take you an amount of time. And they want it now. So, well, if you want it now, you cannot have that. You can have this instead. And you need to be able to kind of convince them, right? And
that's right. Exactly. It's just, like I said, half of those skills are those people skills, the kind of the leadership skills of also knowing when to be there and also just when to back off and let your team work, but making sure that you're there if they have questions or need some guidance. And that is not easy. You know, one of the things I was going to mention, Obed, about these soft skills is you can do a lot of reading. You can go through trainings. But isn't it funny? The soft skills are one of the hardest things to learn in architecture. Yet we call them soft skills. I usually give the advice to people. You can read about these and stuff, but the way to develop really keen soft skills is just to start practicing them. Learn from the mistakes. Don't be beating yourself up for making a big mistake and destroying a relationship at work or something just because you were hot-headed or blew up. Learn from it and kind of reflect on those. And that's the way, in my opinion, to develop really good soft skills and people skills. You know, it's just trying it out, just doing it.
Yeah. That's very interesting, right? It's hard to get soft. Yeah, I never thought about it. And yeah, it's actually true. And it's for the kind of person that is working on a computer all day long, a relationship with people is kind of hard, you know? That's at least that's for my case or for many of my friends. It's kind of, we are more of the computer guys, not the social guys. And for having soft skills, you need to be social, you know?
Yeah.
You need to be able to get aside the awkwardness of meeting new people or you know, speaking up your opinions, right? Because that at the end of the day is something that it's needed for an architect. You need to speak up whatever is on your head at the moment of a decision. So there is this then, you know, soft skill about being a good negotiator, about being able to let it go. What else do you think is important? Besides leadership.
Yeah. So other kind of soft skills, I mean, the core people skills, I mean, that kind of, they all really blend in when we talk about leadership and negotiation and those kind of aspects. Again, team leadership is one of the other things which I encourage a lot of software architects to do, even if it's not defined in your role. Now, there's a lot of people, Obed, who call themselves technical architects. Like, I'm not a people person. I really just want to focus on the solution. But, you know, Gerald Weinberg was very famous for quoting, every problem that we, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember the exact quote now all of a sudden. every problem that we have is a people problem. And when I first heard his quote in the mid 90s. And I thought, what a ridiculous statement. No matter what the problem is, it's always a people problem. And I said, no, it's not. I've got technical problems every single day. I have no idea what you're talking about. And I didn't understand that quote. Mm-hmm. And I kept reflecting on it and saying, this guy's famous. I mean, he wrote that, I believe, in the late 60s in The Art of Programming. And I said, boy, I mean, I don't get it. So I started reflecting on it and realized, yeah, we have technical problems, but we may have questions that we have to ask somebody. Somebody has to test our code. Somebody has to deploy our code. Somebody's using our code. We have to understand the requirements. All of that involves communicating and collaborating with people. And it took a while, but I finally understood exactly what he meant. And if you just reflect back, for those of you even listening on this podcast, and just think about your work environment, think about people that you communicate and collaborate with. Which ones do you like working with? And which people do you really dislike working with? And then sit back and ask yourself, what is it about that person that really makes me want to collaborate with them on something? Then part three is reflect it back on yourself and ask yourself, what kind of person am I? You know, how am I to deal with? You know, and it really forces you to think about your conversations and actions and being abrupt maybe, or shutting somebody down when they have an idea. And by doing that reflection and observing people that do make an influence in your life, it's a really good way of self-reflection and kind of starting to facilitate that change to really become somebody people really want to listen, have you listen to or to work with you. So, you know, those are some of the tips that I usually give people in this whole gamut of soft skills and people skills.
Yeah, because as you just say, it's at the end of the day, people will use the software, right? So, so it's related to people, nonetheless.
It always
right?
is. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And you know what? I'm not sure if this is a good example of a soft skill or not, but there is this thing that I learned like some time ago regarding ask questions, like the question behind the questions, and sometimes the business requirements are there because some reason. And you cannot blindly accept that, right? You need to ask questions and you need, why do you need what? Why do you need that? And then they give you an answer, and then maybe that answer is not enough for you. So you need to be able to ask questions.
Yeah,
exactly.
It was a matter of fact, Obed, Neil Ford and I, in our book, The Fundamentals of Software Architecture, coined two laws of software architecture. The first one being everything in software architecture is a trade-off. But our second law of software architecture, why, is more important than how. Exactly what you just said. Understanding how something works. I can look at an architecture diagram. I can see how things are interconnected and how the flow of the requests work. I can see how it all works. But what I don't see is why you made certain decisions, why you chose certain workflows or certain paths or certain topologies or certain architectures. And indeed, you are so absolutely correct. That why piece is critical, not only in understanding architectures, but you're right, understanding why we're doing what we're doing. I love this example of it. So let's say that the infrastructure team is instructed to move all operations to the cloud. They'll say, okay. But they say, well, I don't know why. And so they ask the developers, and developers say, oh, because we're developing cloud native applications now. And in order to be cloud native, we deploy in the cloud. And all of a sudden, the operations and infrastructure folks have a context. But then the developers wonder, wait, why are we developing cloud native applications in the first place? And they asked the architects. And the architects said, because we're writing everything in microservices now. And microservices is cloud native. Cloud native needs to be in the cloud. Like, oh, got it. But then the architects say, I don't know why we're converting everything to microservices. So they ask the business. And the business says, because we're providing new and better features for our customers, we have to get those features out fast. And microservices allows that level of agility. And it's like, ah, fantastic. That's great. And you guessed it. The business sponsors say, wait, why are we providing new and better features? And it goes all the way up to the very top, the CEO, who says, oh, because we want to be the number one insurance company in the nation. You're so right about that pyramid of continually asking why, like a three-year-old. Those of you listening with kids know exactly what I'm talking about. So, you know, why is the sky blue, Daddy? Why is the ocean blue? Why is the grass green? Why is, like, stop asking questions. But that's the kind of person you absolutely want to be. Because once you understand the very top of that pyramid, you've got a context and a motivation. It works magic, and it's such a simple technique. Yeah, I encourage everybody to continually ask, why are we doing this anyway?
Yeah, it may sound silly sometimes, right? Because you are challenging a business requirement, let's say. We want to do this thing, right? And you can ask, and why this is important, right? And that's maybe a silly question, because it's a business requirement, it should be important. But when they come out with the answer, you can get more context and understand better why is the reason of this thing, right? And that's great. So far I have, well, you know, all soft skills related to people, right? Being a leader, and then being able to challenge with questions, being able to be a good negotiator, and being able to let it go or pick up your battles, as you say, right? Yeah. So those are great things that I guess everyone, including everyone, should be, including myself, should be working on, right? And the thing is, as you say, these are things that happens to be there because you practice them, right? And there will be times where you do things incorrectly, and then you need to learn from those mistakes, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. Best way to pick these skills up, yep, is to start using them.
And on one of your lessons, you talk about this soft skill about keep learning and learning. You call it technical breadth or something like that.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And that one, I loved it, you know, because since I saw that video, I always pick up like 10 minutes of my day to learn something new. And that's great. There are a lot of things right now that I didn't know even exist. And now that I see them, I know how I didn't know about this, you know? And that's great, because sometimes you get focused on your work and your things you do, and you don't see the broader things that are happening there. Yeah. So I like to expand on that, because it's a great thing. And you have like three or four key points that can help you to cultivate it better, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's so interesting, Obed, because one of the impacts, and as a matter of fact, this just happened to me last week. One of the impacts of expanding your technical breadth, in other words, kind of those things that you know a little bit of, you know about them, but you don't know them. You know about them because you know what it is. You know a buzzword. You can associate it with something. What ends up happening to most people, and it's happened to me several times, and almost every one of my colleagues, is something called the imposter syndrome. You see, as you pointed out, when we focus narrowly on a particular technology, we become an expert in that. I can go to conferences, I can speak on it, I get hired for that expertise. And it really builds up your self-confidence. It really does. However, once you start going broad, you know, maintaining still some technical depth, but once you start going broad, suddenly it does something to your ego, your self-esteem.
I know nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And it's called the imposter syndrome. It was a term coined in the late 70s by psychologists. And what it means is somebody unable to externalize their accomplishments. Like you said, I'm not worthy. And boy, it happened to me about a week and a half ago when the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar, as a matter of fact, one of the sources I cite in that video, the November issue of the ThoughtWorks Technology Radar came out. And I love reading the radar. I mean, this is free, thoughtworks.com/radar, or just Google ThoughtWorks Radar. Anyways, this is a collection of most of the brightest people in our industry. Neil Ford, Rebecca Parsons, Jamak, one of my co-authors, as a matter of fact, for our Hard Parts book, Martin Fowler, James Lewis, Pramod Sadalge, another one of our authors. These are people who have a pulse on what's happening at their clients and in the industry. Here's my point. I took a look at the radar, the latest issue. I got to tell you, Obed, I walked away from reading that whole radar not feeling like I knew much because there were so many things, so many new platforms and technologies and tools that I just wasn't aware of. I didn't even know they existed. That's that bottom area of knowledge. And so I started researching some of them, but it even happened to me. I'm like, I started to lose some of my self-confidence because it's like, there's a lot of stuff I don't know. So I caution everybody, it will happen, but don't worry because the broad technical breadth that you start to gain becomes a really, really valuable tool, everyone, valuable tool. When you're faced with a problem and all of a sudden, I know 10 or 12 possible solutions now, not just one. And that is incredibly valuable. So you can Google imposter syndrome and you can see all sorts of, there's great podcasts, there's great videos, conference sessions about how to avoid imposter syndrome and how to kind of get yourself beyond it.
But isn't it that bad? I mean, having imposter syndrome isn't that bad because at the end of the day, you are still learning more stuff, right?
Oh, exactly. It's just, it does impact you to say, boy, I don't know very much, do I? And it gets a little scary because you keep thinking, I should know this stuff and I don't.
yeah, exactly. And then there is this thing that you just mentioned a few minutes ago regarding microservices. And microservices lately has become a trend, let's say it that way, because cloud native applications and the cloud development has been something that makes microservices very appealing, right? So everyone wants to develop microservices now. And there is basically a trend where everyone is going to the cloud because of microservices. So I have been thinking about this from quite a long time now. And I believe, and maybe you can change my mind, but I believe not everything, it's a good idea to become microservices. There are monolithics that are okay as they are like that.
Oh yeah.
And then I guess that I wasn't that wrong because I was thinking, no. I mean, everyone wants to go to microservices, but sometimes I believe it's not worth it because it's going to be something like it's going to take you a long time. And at the end of the day, the benefits of doing it won't be that good, you know, and even monolithics can live on the cloud.
You are so correct. Yeah.
So what I want to ask you is when or how do I know when a monolithic can be a good fit for being constructed as microservices?
Yeah. Boy, what an important question. It's so vital, this question, because one of the things, a secret sauce when we're either migrating or doing microservices greenfield is exactly what you said. Not every portion of an application has to be microservices. And so you ask, well, what should be then? Or what should stay a monolith? And I do a lot of consulting engagements. And like I said, the past 7 years, most of those have been in microservices. And the very first question I ask, and this is usually when I hit the ground running or when I'm first introduced to the particular project, is I always say, so why? You know, why are you migrating from your monolith? Why is this new application going to be microservices? And I got to tell you, Obed, I get a lot of different reactions. Some of them are just like this. What do you mean? Why wouldn't we do microservices? Seriously. And some are just because it is a trend. Jumping on the bandwagon is a great anti-pattern that describes that. Because our competition is in microservices, that means we should be. And that's not true. You are very accurate that breaking apart monoliths is very costly, very difficult, and very expensive. And there needs to be a good, solid justification for why. And as a matter of fact, you hit a couple of those, which is, for example, cloud, cloud native. As a matter of fact, microservices has had a lot of different names in its 10-year history so far, 8-year maybe. Sometimes people term it cloud native architecture. Some people call it a share nothing architecture. SOA Lite is the first one that kind of came out, which just caused me actually, because so many people said microservices was just SOA Lite, I actually wrote a book called Microservices versus SOA. These are two separate animals in the animal kingdom. They're not even related. They're on opposite ends of the zoo. But yeah, some of those core drivers that I look for and I kind of ask people are the strengths of microservices is really about that level of agility, the ability to respond quickly to change, maintainability, testability, deployability. If I have a change, whether through a new feature or a bug fix, I could change that within a day in microservices because I'm deploying a small single purpose function that does one thing well. And that's what I'm deploying, not the entire monolithic application. Scalability is just hands down great in microservices because we're now able to scale at a function level, which not only saves money, but it's a lot more efficient within our ecosystems. And fault tolerance is another great example of when to use microservices. Because systems, let's face it, systems fail. Code breaks. We run out of memory. There's probably 100 different kinds of errors I could just say right here. And the point is, what breaks a particular function where everything else is now currently running just fine because we're not hitting that function? And these are the great drivers of microservices, which, you know, lead to two business drivers, time to market or speed to market. How fast can we get changes out? And then scalability and fault tolerance give us competitive advantage in the marketplace. And it's no surprise that those are the two biggest drivers, ultimately competitive advantage in the marketplace. It's amazing, Obed. Businesses are finally able to start changing their direction much faster than they used to be able to a decade ago. However, when a business changes direction, the underlying IT systems and those corresponding architectures need to bend and change with them. And a lot of times, monolithic applications can't do that. They can't bend and change that fast. And so consequently, the business is all set to start a new initiative. We can't get it off the ground because of our IT systems are too hard to change. These are the reasons for microservices.
Those are good reasons, not the ones that you get as an answer, right?
Yeah. So these are what I look for in that why question. Again, that all important why question about, so why are you doing microservices? And I look for those kind of drivers. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's great, you know, because I read this book called The Phoenix Project, and it has table. It has a table about how many deployments per day Netflix does, and how many deployments like a normal company does. Right? There are companies that they do deployments like every 2 months because it's a big monolithic, and they cannot afford to do once per week, even, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, being able to deploy fast, it's great thing, you know. There is, you know, Black Friday on few days, right? So you can do quickly a change and deploy it very quickly. But with a monolith, it's kind of a little bit harder, and you need to plan like way before that happens. So that's I guess that thinking on my head, I think that's like the best you can get from, besides scalability, right?
Oh,
from microservices, that it gives you the agility to just do it quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the dangers and pitfalls about microservices, though, is confusing the terms modularity with granularity. And modularity is about breaking apart our monolithic applications into separate pieces, separate deployment units, breaking it up. That's modularity. Mm-hmm. Granularity is about the size of each of those pieces. And I always have this great quote. I coined this many, 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 many years ago. Embrace modularity, but be cautious of granularity. Because it's the granularity part, Obed, where we get into trouble.
Yeah.
We make things too small. They start tying services back all together, and it looks like a big ball of distributed mud. And those are usually not a problem with modularity. Those are a problem with granularity. We get confused with the word micro. Micro means small. And, you know, it's very interesting. That word, microservices, has literally nothing whatsoever to do with the actual physical size of a service. One class, 400 classes, 600 classes, doesn't matter. The word and the name microservices describes what it's doing, not the actual size of it. Single purpose functions deployed as separate units. We confuse this terminology, and too many teams think that what it means is we have to make the smallest possible deployment unit that we can. And that's the granularity problem. And so, yeah, these are a lot of pitfalls and anti-patterns in microservices.
You are describing something that happened to me in the past. I was added to a project with microservices, and basically the concept of microservices is the smaller, the better. So there was microservices for managing customer data. And then there was a microservice for update, one for read, one for aggregate data. So at the end of the day, you have like six microservices for getting customer data. Within the end, as you say, it can be just customer data, microservices, inventory microservices, and so on, right? So I guess that's something that happened because the thing of microservices was more like a trend, and there were not like a lot of people doing it yet. Right. This was like a long time ago now.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Over the years, we've very much learned a lot of hard and valuable lessons about what to do and what not to do in microservices, especially with the data piece. Lots of lessons learned. And I'm really happy, though, Obed, because microservices did, in fact, hit a very high hype curve. And I saw too many companies that I was in embracing this where it wasn't a good fit. And I'm really happy to report that so many companies that I'm in, they're still struggling. However, I'm seeing it used appropriately now in places it should be used. And that's really encouraging. Everybody, of course, has a different view, a different experience, a different set of clients. But I am seeing some improvement in some of those anti-patterns of kind of abusing this architectural style and using it when it's not a good fit for your problem. So thumbs up to a lot of those companies I'm working with that are actually getting it and doing things okay.
And that's great to get those lessons learned from that, right? And one thing that I noticed is that some companies that like are going into the trend because as you say, is my competition is doing it or whatever is the reason they're doing it. And they're doing it into a smart way, I believe, which is doing it like by sections, you know, like we're going to move to microservices, just this small piece of our monolithic. And they're doing it like in a pace that is not that fast, but it's good enough for you to just have that particular piece being microservice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because it makes sense to have it like that and doesn't disturb the whole architecture.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that I learned from your lessons as well is about the structural decay, you know, and you put an example of a bridge, and there is a bridge, and there was a bridge like was built, I don't know, like 100 years ago, right? And that build was that was built to hold up horses or cars, like one or two cars, because there were no many cars, right? And nowadays, well, that bridge will break, right? And that same thing happens with software. Companies get to grow and get to get more users every single year, that they need to have an architecture that can be supporting the new load of users. And I guess that's very interesting and something that we should think on our way to designing something, right?
I agree. As a mathematician, I keep thinking of things in terms of tipping points and inflection points. And you're exactly right, Obed. As companies grow, we get more customers use more features within our applications. You're exactly right. All of a sudden, two factors. One is that just that growth. Does the architecture even support that piece? But number two, the second part is also really interesting about structural decay, because maybe concerns have changed within the company. And instead of scalability, it's all about performance. And we start to see that we may not have the right architecture in place. But what you bring up, Obed, is an extremely good example of exactly why an architect has to be involved in the lifecycle of an application or a system, even after it's well deployed, because who is determining whether the system still scales or whether it's available? Oh yeah, no problem here, until you hit that tipping point, just like you described, that bridge. And all of a sudden applications, they implode. They just stop working. Spin it back up and it crashes right back down. I've been through so many dozens of these situations. And the reason? No one bothered to look for structural decay. Like those bridge pylons that have all those cracks, architects need to continually analyze the architecture. One of the most effective ways of doing that is what Neil Ford evangelized in his book, Building Evolutionary Architectures, with Rebecca Parsons and Patrick Kwok. And that was the concept of fitness functions. Engineering uses these all the time. And Rebecca Parsons said, well, we should be using these as architects. And, you know, fitness functions are just code that you write that continually runs in the background. And it's always looking for trends in scalability, reliability, availability, maybe responsiveness. And as we make changes, we may see an inflection point occur. And all of a sudden, it's like we can pinpoint it and say, what happened on this date? Oh, well, we merged with another company. The merge went through. Aha. And look at the scalability. It's down significantly. Mm-hmm. That's structural decay. Now, chipping away at bad practices within architecture.
Those business functions, is the first time I hear about them. That's interesting. So basically, it's monitoring your application so you are aware of whenever something happens that needs to be addressed as quickly as possible. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
You know, it's interesting you bring that topic up, Obed, because when we take a look at the things that are increasing in trends or the hype curve, you just mentioned one key one, which is observability. And this has become one of the big things, especially in microservices, but in any kind of system, because of these problems. And I became very fascinated with these differences between observability and monitoring. And it turns out there's actually a lot that you can research online really good material about these differences. Mm-hmm. And they are subtle, but they're important differences.
Yeah, so like the same, but not.
Well, so I hear people interchangeably talk about monitoring and observability. And I have to stop them and say, well, you know, there are some differences. I mean, now different people have different viewpoints. I subscribe to the kind of the pyramid of monitoring, which observability is the ability of a particular service or system to expose various metrics. That's observability. Monitoring is capturing those metrics that are sent out. And then analysis is after monitoring. Monitoring is only recording, it's capturing. That's all it is. Now we've got analysis, which is interpreting those results and taking action. And so really there is kind of these three tiers: observability, then monitoring, then analysis. But most people lump it all into just monitoring or observability.
and you know what? There are these Spring Boot actuators and stuff like that helps you with observability, right? But exactly. What I find interesting is that there are many companies that understand this problem and they create Dynatrace and, you know, those companies that help you to monitor, even when you don't have good observability on your systems, they help you to get a lot of sense of what is going on behind the scenes. And that's something to look for. And then you mentioned the structural decay, this pillar, right? And then there is something, when I see that image on your lessons, it's something about, it comes to my mind, the technical debt. You know, there is something that we know in this industry, wherever there is something that can be done and you don't do it right, you put it there as technical debt. And then that technical debt goes grow. And at the end of the day, you have something that is kind of impossible to manage or kind of impossible to maintain, right? And I guess many, many companies around the world, even the biggest companies, suffer of this thing, you know, because there are deadlines. And I believe that's the main reason of the technical debt, the deadlines, because there isn't, like, you need to deliver feature X by 2 months. Right. And, you know, feature X can be delivered in that time, but you need more time to do it. But when there is not enough time, you ended up doing the things in a way that is not a good way, you know. And this Phoenix project talks about that, about technical debt and how you should avoid it. But in your experience, how do you think we should approach this thing of having technical debt?
Yeah, I've got two good opinions, strong opinions about this. First, I see too many architectural concerns being chalked off as technical debt. One of the ways I avoid that is I encourage all the companies I work in to adopt architectural stories. Because the point is, if we have a problem and it's impacting scalability, yep, we'll deal with that later. But scalability is critical to the success of this application. That, folks, is not technical debt. That is a business need that's not being met. And so by forming architecture stories, it gives that gives the architect, myself, a little more negotiation power when actually negotiating with a product owner about what kind and number of stories are going into the next iteration. And if I have three architecture stories, now we can talk about the trade-offs of not doing them versus skipping out some functionality and tackling some of the refactorings we need because of maybe a change in the business or functionality. So that's one part. But I was reviewing a book by Jules May, and I know Jules from, he's in Scotland, and he has a very interesting aspect about technical debt that I am more and more adopting. His view is that technical debt is defects in the system. It's an interesting way of thinking about technical debt. Think about it. At first, I wasn't sure I agreed with Jules, but now I'm more aligning with that viewpoint because if you have technical debt, that means code that you did, as you said, Obed, you didn't get to finish, or that wasn't quite written correctly. I need to refactor it because it's not as reliable as I want it to be. Describe every kind of technical debt story you have written and carved off to do it a later time. I would urge everybody listening to this podcast to take a look at your technical debt stories, and you will start to see the fact that these are all defects in the system. Because if there was no code to change, there would be no defect. If there's code to change, even to clean it up, that means there's something wrong with that functionality. And if you take this mindset, all of a sudden you realize that this is not just stuff to clean up, but these are true defects. And those companies that strive for zero defects in the code obviously can't have any technical debt stored up. And so it's kind of an interesting concept. And I'm more and more evangelizing this as a means of saying, address the technical debt to get it to zero. Because if you have technical debt, mark them as defects instead. These are defect stories. And they start to become a little more significant.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking on technical debt, like the other way around, which is something that is not complete. And let me give you an example of what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. There are new requirements that arise, right? And then you as a developer write the code to fulfill that requirement. But then you didn't write any unit testing. And for me, not having a unit testing for your code, it is kind of a technical debt, not a bug, but a technical debt, because you don't have the certainty that it's going to work under certain circumstances that you didn't program to test. So that's what I was thinking. Every time I see a class that is not having unit testing, I see that as technical debt. It's some code that was written that there was not enough time to think it through to create a unit testing for it.
Hmm. So interesting. That's a good example. Again, is that then a defect? Because if you didn't write a unit test case in your suite for that, are there bugs then in that code?
Yeah, well,
but you introduce a bug. Yeah. And so it's kind of interesting. You can still kind of equate it to a particular defect in the system, meaning I'm not sure if this code will always work. Why not? Well, because I didn't write a unit test case for it. That's why.
Yeah.
And other code may change that impacts this. And if we don't have a unit test case for it, that code might break. I'm starting to deal or treat those as defects in the system. So it's interesting, but that's a really good example, Obed, of very classic technical debt. Yeah, very classic. Or writing something with an incredibly high level of cyclomatic complexity. We know we shouldn't, but we don't have time to, quote, do it right. So what do? We've got a 9 to 18 level nesting if statements. Is that code reliable? Probably not. And so a technical debt story may be, yeah, I want to at some point clean that code up and use a kind of a different design pattern to make it better. But what is making it better? Make it more reliable. Ah, so you're saying your code's not reliable. No, I can't maintain it. That's a defect.
Yeah, you're right. So yeah, at the end of the day,
it's an opinion.
I guess it makes sense as well. Yeah.
You know, the other problem we're talking about here, Obed, is quite frankly, who's going to care about that technical debt? In other words, it's something we got to do later, but there's always higher priority stories that we have to tackle. And that's why it's debt. Mm-hmm. And paying off that technical debt, I know a lot of teams, as a matter of fact, that do the traditional approach of a particular iteration is only reason we have that iteration. There's no new functionality, no new user stories. It's either architecture stories or it's a technical debt payoff. And we invest a 2-week iteration to pay off some technical debt. And that helps clear out that backlog. You know, those are some of the techniques I've seen some teams use. Do you have others that you've seen?
Yeah, I have seen a mixture where whatever there is, a release for a new feature, and inside that release, they put some like user stories for fixing technical debt that was there like long time and nobody took care of it. And then next iteration, we add a little bit more or into it.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. There's so many ideas that come out, like making it a reward system. The more a developer addresses technical debt, you get TD points, technical debt points, or you get credits. And then the one who has the most credits gets a reward. There's games you can play, but the problem with it is all of a sudden it's a moneymaker for everybody because all of a sudden you've just passed everything off as technical debt so that you can get the reward points.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work so well.
Great idea. Yeah. And I have other question. It's related to design level versus architecture level decisions, because you mentioned that on your lessons. And I guess it's not quite clear for me what is the difference between design level and architecture level decisions.
Yeah.
I was going to say that when you're an architect, you are designing. So design level versus architect level is kind of, for me, was kind of the same thing. But that's what I want to understand better.
Interesting. I've struggled with this, you know, what is design versus architecture quite a bit. And I used to say, and I still kind of do, that an architectural decision is one that impacts the overall structure of the application or impacts one of the architecture characteristics that's critical or vital to that application. Now, it's interesting. Neil Ford and I have thought a lot about this problem. And what we realized is that we were thinking about it as a binary, architecture or design. And in fact, what we came up with was the fact that it's not a binary, it's in a spectrum. And we identified five main points and we label them A through E. So A is a certain decision that clearly is architecture. For example, we will use the microservices architecture style for this new system. It's all the way on the end of the spectrum. Yeah. But it's interesting, as we start moving down the spectrum, it really becomes, and a good way to identify and define these, Obed, is who is responsible for making that decision. Is it an architect, a tech lead, or a developer? And once you put that responsibility, it really helps. First of all, making sure people aren't stepping on each other's toes or making decisions in a camp that they shouldn't be making decisions in. And that spectrum does exist. We're right in the middle of it, which is line number C there, is right between architecture and design, is where architects collaborate with tech leads and or developers to come up with the decision. A really good example of that middle ground is the choice of, let's say, we will use AWS for our hosting platform. All right. Now, maybe these are business-driven decisions, but if the business says, tell us what platform we should use, irrespective of contracts and costs, that's something that an architect cannot make on their own. It's something a developer probably shouldn't be making either. That fits, in my opinion, right in that spectrum in the middle, yeah. A collaboration between the two to investigate the kind of services, what the application's doing, what services would be leveraged, and all of these kind of considerations. And so most decisions end up being kind of around that middle that we think architecture, around B to C, kind of right near the architecture or the kind of the middle of that spectrum. But that is one really good way of trying to come to grips with that is, should I, as an architect, be making this, or should a developer be making this decision? So, but yeah, it still is a gray area, certainly, but the spectrum does really help.
Yeah.
Both parties knowing if developers should contact an architect and say, hey, can you work with us on this? And vice versa. An architect go to the development team and say, hey, I want to discuss this with you.
So let's say another example of level C is going to be something like which JMS tool use, or even use, RabbitMQ or Kafka, wherever it fits for the solution. So there are things that you can discuss with developers which at the end of the day, they're going to implement, or infrastructure, which at the end of the day, they're going to maintain, right?
So, Obed, to me, the use of asynchronous communication is very much architectural, because there's trade-offs involved, more significant trade-offs. However, the implementation of whether we should be using RabbitMQ, Amazon MQ, an SQS service, or maybe HornetQ, or you're right, ActiveMQ, a lot of times that's probably in the B range, in my opinion. That's more about the implementation of that particular thing. What would slide it over to C, which is kind of in the middle of the spectrum. I meant D. It goes A, B, C, D, and E. E is developer, A is architect. So you've got that kind of wide spectrum. But what would slide it more to from a D, which is a developer decision, over to C, which is collaboration, is really, does it impact any of the particular characteristics that are critical? Is availability a key factor? Is responsiveness a key factor? Data integrity, all of these kind of aspects that may then bring an architect in to look at the trade-offs between some of those choices. But yeah, that's a really good example of that gray area, leaning probably more towards design than architecture. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Good. So now I understand it. Thank you very much for the help on that. And then you just introduced yourself as you being an consultant, right? An independent consultant and working for many companies. And that's something like I dream of. Like, I am an employee, but I'll dream to do like what you're doing, right? So I want to understand, how do you manage to say, I'm going to be an independent consultant and I'm going to focus on training and teaching people how to do stuff?
You know, it's so funny. Yes, today is Tuesday. Yeah, yesterday I actually got an email from somebody asking me this exact same question. how do I become an independent consultant? I've had a kind of an interesting journey because I've been in the industry for 36 years. 35 of those I've actually been a consultant. Now, for most of those, up until about 10 years ago, I was always a consultant, but always hired by a consulting firm. And so I would draw a salary. And if I'm not working, it's called being on the bench, of course. But that was a valuable experience as a consultant, because I got to see different environments, different configurations, different problems. But then I felt like I had enough notoriety to become an independent consultant, which means I don't draw a salary. I form contracts and I work with companies and I get paid hourly or however we work on this. But if I get sick or I take a vacation, I don't get paid. The first thing that kind of led me to stall on being an independent consultant was risk. I have a family and I was nervous about the part about being out of work. And what if the things dry up? I'm not making a salary and I'm not drawing a salary. And that was a little scary. But one of the pieces of advice I usually give if somebody says, you know, I'd love to be an independent consultant, one of the first things is notoriety. Because if I'm going to advertise myself to say, I would like to work for your company, and I don't have a large company backing, it's just me. You have to have some street cred, basically. And great ways of getting that is to start maintaining blogs, start writing articles, like Obed, like you're doing, start doing these podcasts, maybe, you know, write for some periodicals or, you know, online news articles or something. Start to speak at user groups. This is how I got my start, by doing all of those things. And then eventually, of course, starting to write books and starting to speak more, speaking at conferences. But gaining that notoriety is one key element in my experience of being an effective independent consultant. When you're able to show somebody your book, like my JMS book is a great example. People are like, oh, so if you wrote that book, you probably know it. Yeah, yeah. Cool. We want you in here.
Yeah.
But that's one of the key factors. It used to be way back in the day, I'm going back 25, 30 years, Obed. The saying used to go, as an independent consultant, you had to have at least, at a minimum, 1 year's worth of salary liquid in the bank. And I'm like, what? I don't even have $100 in the bank. What do you mean? What do you mean a whole year's of salary? But that was always the conventional wisdom back about 25 or 30 years ago. I don't know what it is now, but I think it's really good advice.
It is like the backup net, right?
It's your safety net. Yeah, exactly. Oh, but it's something to fall back on if, in fact, well, a pandemic hits and all of a sudden things dry up and projects stop and you're like, uh-oh, yeah. I need some backup. Then you've got it. You've got that safety net. It's really good advice. And like I said, I don't know what the conventional wisdom is now, but I would still offer that same advice that start gaining notoriety and differentiate yourself and become known and make sure you've got that bankroll to fall back on if you get sick or get into a car accident or all this kind of stuff. So, yeah. But I will tell you this. Moving to an independent consultant was one of the many really good decisions I made in my career. My main driver for going independent was having control of my schedule, my time off, which I rarely get to take. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, I had more control over my career about what projects I wanted, what projects I didn't want to take, different avenues that I wanted to focus on in my career. I had the control and the power to do that. And those were the drivers for me saying, it's time to go independent. And I can't tell you, it's just been so incredibly rewarding. Since I did make that switch, like I said, about 10 years ago.
That's great. I believe I am as you were kind of before when you think I have a family, I cannot risk it. But yeah, my dream is to be like an independent. As you say, you can work on whatever you want, as opposed to your employer puts you whenever they need to put you in.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My lifestyle, Obed, just doesn't conform to a 2-week vacation schedule.
For hiking.
Yeah. Well, especially for hiking, but it just doesn't work on my lifestyle. And it's always been a contention point in any employer that I've ever had. I just would desire and need more time off. And, we're talking, I work in excess of 60 hours a week. And so it's not like I'm only working part-time. But once you have a run of 2 or 3 weeks of 60 to 70 hours a week, I want to take some time off and regenerate and restore not only my body, but my mind. And so, yeah, that allows me that flexibility. And so I really like that piece.
Yeah, that's great because you manage your time. And that's one of the, when you have family, that's great also because you can take like family trips whenever you want. I mean, depending on what you choose to work on, right? And what one of the things that I like a lot about doing this podcast is that I learn a lot and I learn a lot from people like yourself. Yeah. And I want to ask you if you have some kind of people that inspires you to be better, because I guess we all have somebody that says, I want to be more like that. Or this person inspired me to be better. So I want to ask you what about that?
Yeah, that's a really easy answer. My friend I've known for 15 years, Neil Ford. Neil's a meme wrangler and architect at ThoughtWorks and has been for quite some time now. But he really comes to mind very first as that person. He's got some great ideas. He brings me in to some of these ideas. Our first book idea was generated 7 years prior when Neil and I were talking, and he said, You know, there's really nothing out there that shows a really comprehensive view of the whole gamut of software architecture, the techniques, the technical, and the soft skills. You know, we ought to do that together. And I said, oh, Neil, I don't have the time. No. He's like, no. Both of us collectively have so much experience. Let's do this. And he kept pushing me. And I said, okay. And that turned into a great material, which turned into our first video that we did on O'Reilly, which then turned into our fundamentals book. And we just continued that with our latest book, The Architecture of the Hard Parts. And as a matter of fact, Neil and I are both meeting in person next month, actually. Yeah, next month to start working on the outline and proposal for our next book.
That's great.
Yes, yeah, so he is really the person who inspires me really the most. Yeah. His push of all that.
I know Neil for the trainings because you and him usually do the trainings in pairs.
Yeah, we do a lot of training together. Yeah.
Yeah. And then what kind of music do you like that I can put on my Spotify and listen to what you listen?
I like all types of music. However, I really, my musical tastes, it's interesting, kind of does shift a lot based on not only just the time frame, but also my mood. But as well, I was going to say, as you can see, but we don't have the backdrop. I do play the violin and ukulele and guitar. And so consequently, I really love Irish music on the fiddle. Okay. I love violinists, two of my favorites, which is kind of more, I would say, I don't know how I'd even classify it other than just maybe, I'd hate to say the word easy listening, but kind of folk folk slash maybe pop. But Taylor Davis is one of my favorite violinists. And then Lindsey Stirling is another one. These two are, I could listen to them all day.
Cool. I'll take a look at them.
Yeah. But I also like other music. I really love Red Hot Chili Peppers. I mean, I love their music. The Boundary Water Boys is a great Irish band that plays a lot. Well, it's not necessarily Irish, but kind of contra, but plays a lot of great fiddle tunes. And so I kind of listen to a lot of guitar. I listen to a lot of fiddle and violin music. You know the difference between a violin and a fiddle?
I don't.
Ah, a fiddle has beer stains on it. It's an old fiddler's joke because it's the same. Here's the funny thing about it. It's the same exact instrument, by the way. It's just how it's played. You know, usually a violin is played in more of a classical kind of method, whereas a fiddle you take to an Irish pub and you play, which is why it always has beer stains.
Oh, okay. But it's the same instrument?
You play it. Yeah, it's just how it's played. Yeah, it's the style of music that's played.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking at it. Well, it looks like a violin.
I've got three. Yes, I've got three violins. Cool. So, yeah.
I love the violin because when you know how to play it, it sounds beautiful. But when you don't, it's like, oh my God.
Even those of us who do play, it still sometimes sounds really bad when you're learning a new song. Yes, yes.
And then I also ask about the book. A recommendation of a fictional book or non-fictional book, whatever the kind of you would like to recommend me to add to my bookshelf.
Yeah, so I I actually maintain a reading list of all the non-technical books I'm reading. And it's actually on my website. If you go to developer2architect.com and go on the About Me page, you'll see kind of my JSON card. And it says my reading list. And so I keep that up to date. I actually use it to say, wait, did I read that book before? Or how did I like it? Sometimes I don't remember because I read so much. But I do have, I don't necessarily have actually a favorite book, but rather I have favorite authors.
Okay.
Four in particular that are my favorite authors of all time is Bernard Cornwell, who wrote a lot of the Last Kingdom, the whole Viking series. He's written a lot about a lot of, well, they're all historically accurate novels kind of thing, but anything he's written, I absolutely love. Joe Abercrombie happens to be one of my favorite kind of science fiction fantasy authors. And as a matter of fact, I'm reading one of his books, The Heroes, right now, which I'm absolutely loving, but I just really love that. My friend turned me on to perhaps one of my top five books, which is from Carlos Luis Safon, which is Name of the Shadow of the Wind, not to be confused with Patrick Ruffa's Name of the Wind, Shadow of the Wind, which was just such an amazing book. It's a Spanish translation, but it was, not only was it interesting, it was just so beautifully written. That's one of the top books, I would say. Cormac McCarthy is another one of my favorite authors. The Road, he wrote, is a very dark, dark book. It actually was one of the very few books that actually made me cry, as a matter of fact. But it was so incredibly powerful. It's one of the books I'll read again. But it's like I said, it's quite dark, but it's an incredible, incredible novel. So those are some of my favorite authors.
Yeah. Sorry, you say the Spanish translation? So you know Spanish?
Un poco.
And we're talking in English.
Well, yeah.
So do you know to get around to get some food and stuff like that, or you know enough to have a conversation?
Enough to mostly know some words. I can read Spanish fairly well. Speaking it is a different story. I find I struggle with speaking Spanish, but I can read Spanish. So I've been actually learning Spanish. I actually started learning it for a conference in Barcelona until I realized Barcelona is Catalonia, not...
Yeah, it's not Spanish.
So that was a rude awakening. Although when I was talking, most people were able to translate. But it was like, oh, all that time. But I've always been interested. Years and years and years of learning Spanish. It's hard to learn a language when you get older. And so I've been, you know, kind of keeping with it, but struggling a bit. But yeah, so I know I thought about that, Obed. I was thinking, boy, it would be a little bit of a challenge, but it would be great to actually do the podcast in Spanish. But I'm like, no, I don't know it nearly.
We could try to do the end of the podcast in Spanish if you like.
No. Oh, I definitely do not want to embarrass myself in a good podcast.
All right. Okay. Well, that's great. That's great. I didn't know you knew Spanish, but if I say something in Spanish, you maybe will be able to understand it if I do it like slowly.
Maybe. Yes. Like I said, the reading comprehension piece is great, but listening, I also find big challenges. One of the reasons, as a matter of fact, Obed, that when I do a lot of training or podcasts or conferences in other countries, I purposely slow down my pace, because I can really appreciate, especially English as a second language. Sometimes I talk so fast, it's like no one's even close to understanding what I'm talking about. So I have learned, especially in this virtual world, to kind of start slowing down my speech a bit and doing more effective pauses so that people can kind of catch up in that translation that immediately happens.
But, yeah, and I was thinking that was because you are very good doing training that you learn about doing that, like take pauses so everyone can digest better. So it was more for people that does not speak the native English language.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. No.
All right. So, and then what kind of movies or TV series do you like? Do you like to recommend if you see any?
You know, I mostly read. I do not watch TV at all. I'll occasionally watch movies and such, but I kind of like, I've got some, of course, as most people do, I have some guilty pleasures. I do happen to like action movies, quite a bit. Yeah. That's mostly the genre. That and Westerns. I really love Westerns. So those are two genres I tend to watch some movies in. But it's interesting that you asked this question, because just the other day, I was talking with my father-in-law about, you know, what would you say was one of your favorite movies? And he thought about it, and he's like, "Why? I don't know. He's 91, and he has seen a lot of movies." And he's like, "Well, what's yours?" And I thought about it, and I said, "I don't know if I have a favorite, but one movie I really love was the original Godfather, 1972, with Marlon Brando."
Yeah.
And it got me thinking about that movie, which I haven't probably seen in at least 8 years. And so I've actually got it on my to-do list on my phone right here to actually rewatch it sometime this week. It's just such a classic movie. But I do like classics when I do watch movies. But I usually don't watch a lot of shows. I just got through actually watching Bloodline on Netflix. And now, that was a pretty intense three or four seasons, I think. Was really good. But like most shows, I get disappointed. The end, it just, things don't resolve themselves, or the ending is bad. And I'm like, yeah, I'd rather just read.
Yeah. Yeah, you say Godfather, that's one of my favorites as well. And I feel that that movie is like, even though it has been many years it has been created, it looks like very fresh, you know? It's very well done, yeah.
Yeah. I found that one it was very intense, but it kept me interested. It did.
Yeah. And is there something that you like to say before we ended up the podcast?
You know, I've really enjoyed your questions, Ovid. This has been such a fun podcast. You know, usually they're so structured and you're cued with all these things. And I felt like this was just a really, really fun and good conversation. And so kind of the last thing is just really, I fully appreciate you having me on your podcast. And this has been a really fun talk. I hope that people listening have enjoyed our conversation as well.
Yeah, I enjoy it a lot. And that's the idea of the podcast, just to have like a regular chat, because I was talking with another friend in another podcast, and he says, "I like podcasts because you feel like you are in the conversation with them, because there is like a natural conversation." So it's like, I think the same. I mean, you can relate because it's just two people talking. And sure. I like that format. And I am very pleased to have you here. And I'll switch to Spanish to say thank you. So you see, you listen to my thanks in Spanish. Mark, muchas gracias. Aprecio mucho que estés acá conmigo. La verdad que estoy muy emocionado. Y creo que va a ser un episodio que les va a gustar mucho a mis amigos. Did you get what I said?
I got most of that. Yes, indeed. And I'm not even going to try to respond in Spanish.
Yeah.
My translation part of my brain, being the age I am, still doesn't have that immediate rapid response piece. But yeah. But yes, I did catch most of that. And gracias. And and I don't know how to say thank you. Well, I know how to say thank you, but thank you for having me on your podcast. This is a great experience. So thank you so much.
You are very welcome. And that was it for today, guys. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoy it. Please share with your friends if you like it. And if you don't, just share it anyway. Thank you very much. And I'll talk to you later. Yeah.